Good morning and welcome to At Home This Morning, a magazine programme that we hope will provide you with a look at our world, both in and around the city of Brighton and Hove, and now even further afield, all for both our older listeners, those young at heart, and of course those not so old. In the next hour we'll be joined by Professor Paul Pettit, we'll be talking about the new Sega computer game that aims to rival Kvar. Claire Long from Age UK will be along with news on how you can get a cream tea delivered, either to your own front door or for someone you know. And if you've got a piece of electrical or electronic equipment that has failed, John Bentley will be here with some hints on how to get rid of it without adding to landfill. We'll also be joined by Bruce Allen with some useful guidance on what you can and cannot burn in your wood-burning stove or fire pit following the banning of household coal and some types of wood. And I'll be chatting to Radio Brighton star John Henty in the Pavilion Gardens to find out what his idol, music hall star Max Miller, would think of the group that carries his name are up to. And in this edition of the programme, we'll continue to celebrate the world of musical theatre, so that we can celebrate the reopening of our venues, both here in Brighton, at Chichester, Eastbourne, and of course the West End. If, like me, you think it's important that history isn't swept under the counter, well, some new events are bringing that to light. And we're joined now by Paul Pettit, professor from Durham University. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Is history important?
Yes, of course it is. I suppose we're all used to the idea that we learn from history and we base our current actions on it. But also, I think the most important thing is that history is part of the way that we discuss things, that we keep human culture alive, that we engage in being humans. So it really is an integral part of modern life.
And how important is archaeology in that conception?
Well, archaeology, of course, is the only way we can look at how humans evolved biologically and culturally in the long term. So written records take us back to somewhere around 3500 BC. They're quite limited in scope at the time anyway. Beyond that, we have nothing except the refuse that we've left behind. So in my mind, if we're to understand how our brains came to be what they are, how we produce all these weird and wonderful things like art and so on, then it has to be archaeology.
So what triggers a memory in our brains?
Well, psychologically, we are visual animals, really. The visual system is the most important of our senses, not that the others are unimportant, but we tend to remember things which are clear visual messages, first and foremost.
And what sort of things do we recognise? What sets us off?
Well, this is quite interesting because the discussion we're having is based on research that Sega have commissioned for the release of their historical strategy game, Humankind. And what Sega were able to do is to survey Brits and find out what the most important, the most memorable, the most affecting historical events have happened over the course of the last half century or so. And the reason they did this is because, in keeping with the Humankind game, we thought it would be interesting to do a just so. What would happen if cave art, which was one of humanity's earliest cultural innovations, if cave art remained the main visual way of communicating historical information. I mean, obviously, we're speaking to each other online. We know the importance of digital technology today, but it's been around a mere heartbeat or less in the grand scheme of things. So we don't know how resilient it is. We don't know whether it's going to survive a few decades more, let alone centuries or millennia. But with cave art, we have images that were painted onto the walls of caves at least 30,000 years ago, which are still as fresh as they were the day we created. So Sager's idea was to take some of this earliest human art and try to depict those historically important events in the modern world, rather like their strategy game will actually do, rather like players will engage in this two-way interaction with history there. So this is where I got involved as a specialist in long-term evolution. My role working with Sager and with the artist Emmy Smith was to ensure that Emmy was depicting some of these events, like 9/11, for example, in ways that were relatively authentic, you know, that the ways that would have been used to depict them had they occurred 30,000 years ago.
So is this something that people can access online, or is it in the gaming world?
Yeah, so this is the release of their historical strategy computer game, which is downloadable from their website. As part of this and through their website, we've produced these artworks, or Emmy has. We actually produced them physically in the Hellfire Caves in Buckinghamshire. Of course, we had to scrub them off of the walls at the end, so they survive only digitally, rather ironically there. But this is all to celebrate the release of Sager's Humankind.
And how can people get more information?
The Sager website for the game is the first go-to place, simply humankind.game, and that will give you all you need to know.
Do you think that cave art, I mean, you talked then about scrubbing off your latest attempts, but do you think it will continue to be found? There'll be new examples of cave art?
Most certainly. In Spain, for example, we have a new cave with engravings or paintings in it discovered every year on average. In France, a little less so. And increasingly, we are starting to realise through modern discoveries that it's not just restricted to France and Spain, but it's found across Europe. Some examples were found in an Indonesian cave, which are very early as well. So it does seem, in pockets at least, to span the whole continent of Eurasia. So yes, it's purely dependent on how many people are out there crawling through caves and looking up at the walls.
So we're going to have cave art with us for many years, either digitally or in real life.
Yeah, and the beautiful thing is now with digital technologies is we can 3D scan those caves, the art on the walls and so on, and one can walk through them on a computer screen, rather like a Sega computer game, or through virtual reality as well. So we can experience them as their original artists and participants in whatever else accompanied the creation of the art did as well. So it becomes this immersive discussion about how to be human.
Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I was talking to Professor Paul Pettit about how 1 million-year-old cave art is being brought to life in a new computer game.
You're listening to At Home This Morning, which is a Grey Matters production for Brighton's Radio Reverb.
Now, who doesn't like a cream tea? Well, Age UK are bringing back a cream tea delivery. You can actually have one delivered to your door or at the doorstep of a friend or acquaintance. And to tell us how you can arrange all that, from Age UK, Claire Long. Good morning, Claire.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Okay. That sounds like a lovely idea, although at this time in the morning, it's perhaps a bit early for a cream tea.
It's always a good time for a cream tea.
First of all, why are Age UK in the business of supplying cream teas?
Well, it's something we trialled last year, and we found that it went down very well. It's an opportunity to put a smile on someone's face. It's a treat in otherwise quite challenging times. And actually, this year, we've decided to change it slightly. And you can either order a cream tea for yourself, as you mentioned, for a friend or acquaintance, but also help raise much needed funds for our charity. We've struggled with obviously our fundraising opportunities over the past 18 months, but also you can arrange for a cream tea to be delivered to a vulnerable older person, which is obviously a lovely thing to do, much needed. Although restrictions are easing for a lot of vulnerable older people, they are still either not confident or not able to get out and about as they would either like or wish. So this for us feels like a really nice thing to do, but also an opportunity to really get out there, show people that we care, but also raise much needed funds.
How much does it actually cost?
The cost of the cream tea is a donation of £7. So that includes the two scones, the cream, the jam, the tea, serviette, knife, etc. So you're ready to go if you want to take it outside for a picnic or enjoy at home. But that also includes the cost of delivery. So this will be delivered to any address in West Sussex or Brighton and Hove. On a morning, either predetermined or if you've got a special occasion, we can do them in bulk. We're quite flexible. We've got a fabulous volunteer army who are delivering these for us free of charge. A lot of the ingredients have been donated, so the cost of the £7 is all of the ingredients, all of the packaging, all of the information that comes with it. So you get a copy of our fabulous magazine as well, and much needed funds for our charity.
How do you go about doing it if you've got somebody in mind?
There are a number of ways that you can order. You can contact us by telephone, and that's on 01903 792211. You can drop us an email, and that's fundraising@ageukwsbh.org.uk. Or you can order through Virgin Money Giving. So that's www.virginmoneygiving.com/fund/cream tea 2021. And anybody can contact our website. Just look up AGK West Sussex Brighton and Hove. And all the details are on there too about all the fabulous work that we do and how you can get involved. So hopefully we've made this as easy as possible for people, but we cannot stress enough how many, vulnerable people there are, across our area who still need our help. This money goes a long way to helping, our services, whether that be befriending telephone calls, meal deliveries, doorstep support, welfare checks, information, advice, you name it. There's a lot of people who need our help out there. So some people are enjoying their freedom, and others just are not able to do so right now. And we want to let them know that we're still here for them.
Thinking about numbers, is there a limit to how many cream teas?
Absolutely not. One of the things that we've been doing this year as well is, if you're getting colleagues or, groups or social groups back together, then we do a bulk delivery. If you order 10, you get one free. We're working with some businesses, some community groups. It's a really nice opportunity to get people back together, whether that be in the office or wherever you usually meet. So that's a really nice opportunity to sort of get people back together, put a smile on their faces, but also support a really worthy cause. So no, absolutely no limits. We've got fabulous cooks, our own cooks, who are making these scones. They're freshly made, handmade. So no, the more the merrier, absolutely.
Remind us of the contact details, if you will.
Absolutely. So at any time, you can find out about all of our services on our website. That's just look up AGK West Sussex Brighton Hove. but to place an order, you can give us a call on 01903 792 211.
And there was an email address as well?
Absolutely. So fundraising@ageukwsbh.org.uk.
I was talking to Claire Long from Age UK, Brighton Hove and West Sussex about, yes, cream tea doorstep deliveries for you and your friends. Would you believe that it's over 40 years since the very first IBM personal computer actually appeared on the scene? To commemorate that and also to recognise what we do with all of our waste from computer gadgets and things like that, we're joined by John Bentley from The Gadget Show and Tim Westbrook, Head of Sustainability from Stone Group. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Is it really 40 years since a personal computer first appeared?
Yes, it is. I think it was 1981 that the first IBM branded PC appeared, and yes, they're still going. I mean, but from the waste point of view, they've been joined by countless other splendidly useful and wonderful electronic gadgets, which nevertheless they do reach the end of their lives, and just add to our seemingly growing number of environmental problems.
This is called e-waste, is it not? So what exactly is e-waste?
Well, I think it's any gadget that comes to the end of it, end of its life. All the computer boards and the components and the screens, it's quite bulky, and is also contains a lot of harmful chemicals, which if it finds its way into landfill and so on, tend to get their way into the water supply and cause quite a lot of damage. So it's a good idea to keep it out.
What can we do as consumers to help this?
Well, there's lots of things we can do. We can keep our gadgets going as long as possible, so as to repair them wherever possible. But crucially, when you dispose of them, make sure they're disposed of somewhere reputable, like your local authority refuse site or a good retailer who will dispose of them for you.
How much of a problem is this, both in the UK and worldwide?
It's a massive problem. Chris, I mean, collectively in 2019, it was 53.6 million metric tons of e-waste. And concerningly, only 17% of that was formally and responsibly collected and recycled. So if you just put that into a picture, really, it just shows you that whilst technology is coming out and it's faster and smarter, we've just got to make sure that when we're done with technology, we use the right sources to dispose of it responsibly. Otherwise, you know, as John said, it's getting into our waterways, it's getting into our soil, and that means it's getting into our food supply chain. And it's the fastest growing waste stream in the world. So it's some serious stuff.
I've already said, what can we do to stop it? But presumably, the end result is that there isn't a way.
There is a way. Us as consumers and indeed businesses need to make sure that when we buy our new technology, when we want to give it back, we need to make sure that where we buy from, they can take it back. And the market needs to dominate that. So a really quick stat, 55% of employees believe that companies themselves should be correctly disposing of e-waste. And you have the consumers and you have the businesses. But if we all make a point of when we go to buy, whether that be a consumer or whether that be in a business, is we always ask our supplier, do you have your own fully accredited in-house recycling facility? Then you've got confidence that when you do dispose of or you do give back your old piece of technology, it's not going to impact the environment.
I mean, that sounds ideal, but if you went into a very well-known hardware store that sells PC equipment, for example, at the moment they would laugh at you.
Actually, I don't think they would they? I think they're actually, well, with larger products, they're legally obliged to take it back. But I think even the big, one of Britain's biggest high street retailers will actually take back any electronic produce, I think, end of life electronic.
Yes. And to that point, what John says is that you've just, again, you need to make sure that when you do hand it back, you ask that question, because you need to make sure that your provider or supplier has taken the time and invested the money so that they can categorically say to you, yes, we can take that back for you and we will safely dispose of it or refurbish it as we see fit. Then you know you're doing the right thing.
If people are intrigued by this story, where can they go to get more information?
There's a lot of information around. If you just Google Stone 360, that's an example of an app and a business that gives particularly businesses the opportunity to safely recycle. And for consumers, if they want more information, there's plenty of websites out there that they can get information from and do it the correct way. So there's twofold here, businesses and consumers.
I was talking to John Bentley about the disposal of old and redundant electrical and electronic equipment to save it going to landfill.
You're listening to At Home This Morning, which is a Grey Matters production for Brighton's Radio Reverb.
We understand that one in five households in the UK are still blasting harmful health pollutants out of their homes by unknowingly burning wet wood in their wood burners, open fires, outside fire pits, and whatever else they find to burn. Joining us is Bruce Allen, CEO of Heatas, to explain the dangers of what is wet wood. Good morning.
Good morning.
What are the dangers of wet wood and what is it?
There's been a change in the law in England where we're no longer allowed to sell or buy wet wood. And also the dirtier coals, the sort of the house coals. So that's gone now as well, in preference of smokeless mineral fuels that have been manufactured. But on the log side specifically, a dry log is specified as a log that contains 20% moisture or less. So it's either been naturally seasoned or it's been dried in a kiln generally. The short and tall of it is we're really trying to encourage people to burn drier wood, which is now called ready-to-burn wood, up to 20% moisture content, because burning that wood reduces vastly the particulate emissions in terms of where before people might have been burning wet wood. So in experiments that we did in laboratories, we found that burning dry wood, say logs in an open fire, for instance, could produce only 20% of the particulate emissions of burning wet wood. So obviously wet wood is a very polluting, very particulate heavy sort of combustion, and it produces creosotes and oils which sit on the chimney and could produce chimney fires. So in terms of wet wood, it's the big message is that it's a no-no. Dry wood is the right thing to do, up to 20% moisture, and you get benefits like it's a better for your pocket because it makes the appliance more effective, more efficient. It's better for the environment because it reduces particulate emissions by vast amounts, and it's better for safety. So that's the general message, Chris.
It sounds complicated. A lot of people will have gone along and bought string bags full of logs and plastic bags full of coal. They can't do that anymore, presumably.
No, but it's quite easy, in as much as the government's introduced a new legislation for England, and all of the stuff that's allowed to be burned has to have a mark on it now. So that's the mark is a simple round mark that says ready to burn on it. So it's like an orange circle with a red flame, and it simply says ready to burn on it. It'll give the supplier's name and their certificate number. And if you see that on things that you're buying, simply that's it. That's what you buy.
What about those places that sold scrap wood from scrap yards, things that have been recycled from building sites and that sort of thing? Presumably they no longer exist.
Well, they shouldn't be burned. I mean, you're not supposed to be burning wet wood, waste wood anyway. The things that we've got to think about is the particulate emissions are fine particles, so they're the sort of things that can get into your lungs if you're not careful. And we're trying to sort of, you know, reduce those vastly. When you're burning wood that is from an unknown source, you don't know what you're burning. You don't know what chemical treatments have been on it, and you don't know what, where the wood came from. Is it legal? Is it sustainable? Is it, you know, all of those things. And we really, really do need to know the source of our wood, that it's legal and that it's up to 20% moisture content, so that we can get the benefits that I talked about, which were, you know, greater efficiency, greater safety, and environmentally responsible burning.
And is it more expensive to use this dry wood?
No. Before the government brought in the legislation, they asked us to work with an accredited laboratory to work this out. So we bought fuel from all around the country in all the different areas, and we got them to burn it and look at the heat output. Burning wet fuel and house coal is inefficient. So wet wood and house coal is inefficient. Ready-to-burn fuels are much more efficient, and you get more heat for your pound, if you like. And the overall figures came out that it is not more expensive to burn drier wood. It's more expensive to buy it initially, but it's false economy if you buy wet wood, because it just, you know, you can't burn water. All you can do is waste heat by boiling it off. And that's just bad for the chimney as well, because it produces creosote.
A lot of our listeners will remember coal fires and coal merchants and everything else. And of course, the UK is built on a huge coal seam. So those days are gone for good.
In terms of the less clean coals, yes, indeed. I mean, if like me, you're over 60 and you come from Wales, you certainly know that there's an anthracite seam that runs under Wales and goes under the sea and comes up in Ireland. Anthracites are very clean coals, and they're, you know, some of their anthracites are exempted, so you can still carry on and use them. But generally, it's the soft bituminous house coals and wet wood that cause the particulate emissions, that cause the chimney fires, and that cause appliances to clog up and soot up and not work efficiently. So anyway, it's false economy to want to burn those things.
What about heritage railways and heritage traction engines and the things that burn steam coal? Are they affected?
Steam coal is an anthracite, so dry steam coal is an exempt fuel anyway, so that's not affected. But so some anthracites that are very hard, very clean burning, you know, dry steam coal, then these will be, they probably won't even carry a ready to burn mark, because they're just exempted under the law anyway. So that, you know, that's how they've got around that one.
It all sounds very interesting and a little bit complicated. But where can people get more information?
Okay, there's three websites. The Ready to Burn website is readytoburn.org, or you can get to the Ready to Burn site from woodshore.co.uk or heatask.co.uk. Once you sort of get into it, it's really simple. It's simply that burn dry logs and smokeless fuels, reduce emissions, increase your efficiency, and make your chimney safer.
Way back in 1965, the world of British music hall lost one of its major stars, Max Miller. And I'm standing in the Pavilion Gardens alongside his statue with what many would say is one of his greatest fans. And of course, ex-BBC Radio Brighton stalwart, John Henty. John, good morning and welcome to Radio Reverb once again. And for starters, please tell us a little bit of the magic that was Max Miller.
Ah, yes, the cheeky chappy. I'm quite right that here we are in the heart of Brighton, and Max Miller was essentially the heart of Brighton. And the reason why there's a society, the Max Miller Appreciation Society, been going now for over 20 years, it was set up because Max was born in Brighton, he lived in Brighton, he died in Brighton, he is Brighton, and that's why we celebrate him, and we're still having meetings every so often. In fact, there's a group of us here on a nice morning, and we're all having a cup of tea and talking about the good old days.
And plan to commemorate Max more positively? You've got the statue.
We've got the statue. We're very proud of the statue, and that was caused and created by a sort of little concert we had at the Theatre Royal some time ago, which was very popular. George Melly was there, Des Lynam was there, name-dropping, Terry Garrigan was there. A whole range of people turned up for that, and we raised £40,000. Fine. And now, if you go to Baker Street in Brighton, Bardsley's the fish and chip restaurant, you will see a lot of Max Miller memorabilia all round the room. It's lovely and we're very proud of it, but most of that actually are photocopies, obviously, in a fish and chip restaurant. We've got a load of permanent stuff, and by that I mean we've got a bust of Max Miller, we've got bill posters of Max Miller, we've got photographs of Max Miller, we've got absolutely everything. We've even got a hip flask that belonged to Max and has got MM on the bottom of it. We've got all this stuff, but most of it, and this tells a story that I'm sure a lot of people will say, my goodness, how true that is. This is all stashed away in boxes, in cupboards, in garages, in shelves, you know, and that's not good enough. And I'll tell you why, because let's face it, we all know this, we're not going to be around together, neither was Max, and we've got to do something to see that all that stuff is saved permanently. We're seeking a home for Max in Brighton.
Now, of course, the Hippodrome was his performing home, and we know that Matson Properties have got dramatic plans for the Hippodrome. It's not going to be locked down, it's going to be altered, but I think it's positive. Do you think that would make a good home?
Yes, 100%. I'm certain of it. Not the entire building. The developers will be glad to know. No, we are seeking a space there. We could finance it. It would be a celebration. It could even be the Max Miller Bar, for example, but that's another story. Yes, we could definitely liaise with this company, go along with it. It's part of the community, which I know is one of their briefs, that they are concerned that the Hippodrome should serve Brighton. And in many ways it can do that. But here's another way, because Max effectively had many homes in the town and beyond, but he always came back to Brighton. And the other thing was that his cultural home was the Hippodrome. He was always at the Hippodrome. And everybody that you meet, they say, oh, I knew Max. You saw him at the Hippodrome. I saw him at the Hippodrome. Everybody saw him there. It's a perfect place. And we're just hoping to negotiate. And if anybody is from the developers listening to this, and I hope they are, you know, we'd love to talk to you. And we're hoping to put a little film together. We're going to call it Finding a Home for Max. And it's going to tell the story of this search. And we want a happy ending. And that could be at the Happy Hippodrome. Oh, I like that.
John, you know, Max was a bit of a divisive character. I mean, as you say, he was known as a cheeky chappy. And perhaps some of his material wouldn't go down in today's PC society.
Excuse me, Mr. English. Had you watched the programmes from the Apollo TV? Most of it is now. Max would turn in his grave if he could listen to it. Now, the thing about Max, and I always say this, and it's absolutely true, he believed in innuendo. It was innuendo. He used to say, I'm not. You're the sort of people who get me into trouble. It was innuendo. Today, it's in your face. You can't escape. It's vulgar, it's crude language. None of us like that. We don't want it. Max was important, and above all else, Max was the number one front of cloth comic in this country. He was the number one stand-up. They all go on about stand-up. Max invented stand-up.
And what do you think is a secret of his success, undoubtedly? And will it be remembered?
Yes, 100%. He is remembered, obviously, by the society. We've got, you know, close on 1,000 members all over the world. Above all else, the thing about Max was that he was likable. You know, you've got to be likable. If you don't, unfortunately, I watch a lot of these comedians and I don't like them. Max was likable and he made you like him. And the other great thing in a town like Brighton is he was liked by men. Because they saw him as Jack the Lad, and he was liked by women because they saw him as, he's a bit of all right, his lovely blue eyes, and he always pinpointed all his comments to the ladies mostly. I know what you're thinking, dear, I know what you're thinking. You know, it's, there's so many. And he's lovely. I like the girls who do. I like the girls who don't. I hate the girl who says she will and then she says she won't. But the girl I like the best of all, and I think you'll say I'm right, is the girl who says she never does, but she looks as though she... Yeah, that was it. It was his timing, Chris. It was his timing. And we get people dressed up as Max, and I don't dress up as Max, actually, wisely. We've got a lot of people who do. And the point is they can go through all his gags, but if you haven't got the timing, people won't laugh. They laughed at Max. He came on with his plus fours, his fantastic hat. He didn't even need to say anything. The music would start. Dun, 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 dun. He'd wait, and then he'd go on the stage, and they were laughing before he'd even opened his mouth.
Going back to the society, how can people get in touch and find out more?
Well, we've got a nice little leaflet, which I happen to have in my back pocket, he said. And there is, first of all, the most important thing. I don't know how many people are on computers, etc., but there is a little www.maxmiller.org. That's all you have to do, and it tells you the whole story, and you can actually see Max as well. There's also a telephone number for people, and can I give that telephone number? It's the lovely Jack Strutt, and it's 01273 500168. Get in touch with him and he'll send you a lot of information. We have a quarterly magazine which is quite brilliant, and we're going strong, and we're going to find a home for Max.
I was talking to John Henty from the Max Miller Appreciation Society. Now our 60 minutes of airtime is very nearly up, and it's just about time for me to say goodbye. And so until we next meet over the airwaves, or however you listen, please don't forget that my co-presenter, Richard Davis, will be here with his next edition in a couple of weeks' time. But there's just enough time for me to say cheerio, and of course to remind you that for the past hour you've been listening to At Home This Morning, which is a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb. And you can listen again to a selection of some of the editions of the show by entering either Radio Reverb or Grey Matters Productions CIC into your internet browser, selecting the Listen Again tab, and then just choosing the actual show or shows you'd like to hear again. And so, until next time we are together, this is a mostly no longer germ-ridden Chris English, signing off with my usual plea for you to all keep safe and well, and please don't forget to encourage all of the young people you know to get their jabs. Bye for now.